Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments I'll be marking the World Day of the Sick by bringing you a personal reflection by Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. And looking ahead to this same date, I'll also be marking the 85th anniversary of the Lateran Pacts. That's with historian Jesuit Father Gerald Fogarty. And on very different notes, I'll be bringing you a musical meditation presented by Monsignor Philip Whitmore. But let's begin, as always, at this time of week with a report on the Wednesday General Audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world. Lydia O'Kane.
Pope Francis was greeted by a sea of people taking cover under umbrellas as he made his way into St. Peter's Square on Wednesday for his weekly general audience. Making reference to the rainy weather, the Pope said, "It's not a nice day, is it?"
Buongiorno, ma non buona giornata,
In his continuing catechesis on the sacraments, the Holy Father focused his attention on the Eucharist, saying that it accompanies us every step of the way on our pilgrimage of faith.
E con l'Eucaristia sentiamo questa appartenenza proprio alla Chiesa, al popolo di Dio, al corpo di Dio, a Gesù Cristo.
Reflecting on the Mass, Pope Francis said it was a banquet that nourishes us not only with the bread of life, but also with the proclamation of God's word in the Scriptures. The Pope went on to say that at the Last Supper, Christ gave us this sacrament when he broke bread and offered the cup as the foreshadowing of his sacrifice on the cross. In this Eucharistic sacrifice, he added, Jesus gave us the supreme prayer of thanksgiving to God, our merciful Father. The Holy Father underlined that the celebration of the Eucharist is more than simply a banquet. It is, he said, a memorial of the Lord's passion, death and resurrection and makes present the Paschal mystery in all its saving power.
Dunque, la celebrazione eucaristica è ben più che di un semplice banchetto.
Departing from his prepared remarks, Pope Francis stressed that we can never thank the Lord enough for the gift of the Eucharist, adding, that is why it is so important to go to Mass on Sundays, to go to Mass not only to pray, but to receive communion, the bread which is the body of Jesus Christ that saves us, forgives us, and unites us with the Father. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Well, our thanks there go to Lydia O'Kane for sharing with us this report. I'd like to mark the first of our special anniversaries, the day the Church remembers Our Lady of Lourdes. For this, I'm about to share with you a very personal reflection by Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese.
Thank you. calling my parents in Wales one evening to ask them if they would like to visit Our Lady's shrine in Lourdes. They were delighted and accepted straight away. The months passed by as normal, but just 10 days before we were due to go, the doctors in the hospital in Chester told my mother she had an inoperable tumour on her lung and would need treatment. Having grown up poor, one of the first things she worried about was whether I would lose any money if she was unable to go to Lourdes. Luckily, she was reassured when I said it didn't matter, but that anyway, she was to make up her own mind and not be bullied by anyone into going or not going. Having grown up a strong Catholic, she decided Lourdes was the best place to be, so we went. Mum had a difficult trip, and some people criticised me for making her suffer the inconvenience and even pain of going to the airport and the indignity of being pushed around Lourdes in a wheelchair. Why bother putting her through all that inconvenience? Poor Dad was at his wit's end and very depressed about why all this was happening. Why bother if the life you have built together has to end like this? And they both hated the attention which naturally comes your way if you're in a wheelchair in Lourdes or pushing one. We are very private people. The change came the day before we went home. Mum was scared of going to the baths at the shrine. The woman from the Isle of Man who took her in told me later on in tears of laughter that Mum was afraid because she couldn't swim. Nobody had told her it was a small bath into which the helpers lower you carefully. She must have thought it was an Olympic-sized swimming pool. I stayed outside with Dad, who was unusually nervous and short-tempered. It was very difficult for him. Why was all this happening? He got an answer when Mum came out with a radiant face, saying, "I've done everything I wanted to do now. Will you take me for a coffee, Peter?" She was amazed by the kindness absolutely everyone showed her. And Dad said that the wait outside the baths and walking around Lourdes had made him realise he had been feeling far too sorry for himself. His eyes had been opened by other people's sufferings. Two little miracles. Mum died less than 3 weeks later. My dad's burden was made much lighter, and the people who had been so critical said how wonderful it was that Mum had had the chance to go to Lourdes. What about me? Well, the big miracle was that this couple who hardly ever went anywhere accepted the invitation so quickly. Most people think of priests and other professional Catholics as people of faith, but I can tell you that on this occasion I was the one who was doing most of the learning. In a way, without wanting to give the wrong impression, I can honestly say that the miracles of the 1850s became distant memories when one sees the recurring miracles at Lourdes today. When I invited Mum and Dad to come, I had to be chaplain to a group which brought with it plenty of work but lots of fun and very moving moments with people I felt really pleased and privileged to meet. Many times in the course of my work, I'm tempted to say, "Why bother staying here?" But my own frustrations paled into insignificance on that special pilgrimage. That has often happened to me on trips to Lourdes, and on visits to hospital or prison, or even to sick people in their homes. The people who wondered whether it was worth bothering to take Mum on a difficult journey to a shrine in a foreign country got their answer, and were gracious enough to admit it. There were also many people like me who went as Christians who often wonder why they should bother remaining in the church, or believing in God, or being good people. I think many of us got our answer too. I would recommend it.
And our thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese for sharing with us this reflection. Moving on in the broadcast, on a more historical note, I'm about to join historian and well-known author, Jesuit Father Gerald Fogarty, in a programme connected to the founding of our radio stations as it focuses on the Lateran Pacts. But why don't you stay tuned?
An intriguing
2, February 11th, 1929. We talk about the Roman question and the Lateran Pax, but there are different parts to that. Lateran Treaty, a Concordat, and a Third Pact, aren't there?
Yeah, it gets complicated. They overlap. A Concordat, for our English-speaking listeners, is important. There's never been a Concordat in an English-speaking country because of the British and American common law. You have the rights that are not restricted by going to court. Whereas in the Roman law tradition, which runs throughout Europe for the most part, you have the rights the state gives you. So therefore, a concordat was an agreement between the Holy See and the government to guarantee the rights of the church within a particular country. And almost every European nation does have a concordat. So therefore, that was one of the things that came in. The treaty was to end the Roman question. There would be an indemnification for what was lost and so forth, the land lost. And the Pope had never touched what had been set aside in the Law of Guarantees in 1872. So now there was a general indemnification. And then included in that was the freedom of communication with his bishops everywhere, and also the right to the diplomatic corps and the right of cardinals, who at that time were given the rank of Prince of the Blood, by the way. They were considered to be royalty and to be treated as such. But thank God we've done
blue
away.
Blood.
Yeah.
So anyway, this definitively put an end to the Roman question.
Yes, and what it meant was, by 1861, all of Italy was now united except for the city of Rome. The city of Rome still remained in the temporal control of the Pope, only because French troops had come to defend the Pope here. So therefore, that's why the end of the control over Rome, that's why it becomes the Roman question. Because after all, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, and yet he never visited his own cathedral. From 1870, St.
John Lateran.
That's right. People, St. Peter's is not a cathedral. It is a major basilica, but the chair is not there. The chair, that is the cathedra, is actually St. John Lateran. And that's where the Pope had...
That's why he's called Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
That's right. And one of his many titles. So that was the significance that now the Roman question was settled with the Holy See recognizing that the Kingdom of Italy in 1929 now had control of the city of Rome, legally. And it brought about a regularization between the two entities.
So it was a rigid and rainy day, and a Mussolini for the Italian state, and Cardinal Gasparri for the Holy See, then it was.
Holy See. And then right after that, Gasparri resigned, and the new Secretary of State was Eugenio Pacelli, who later on became Pius XII. And we could talk about this at some other time, perhaps, but that also brought about a change in the attitude of the Holy See towards the United States. The Holy See regarded the United States in 1899 with great suspicion. Gradually, that starts to change because it was obvious that another war was going to come. And with that other war, the Holy See knew they would have to do something with the United States.
And Pius XII was the first to visit the United States, but not as Pope.
That's right. In 1936, the first Pope to come as Pope was Paul VI. But Pacelli came over in 1936, supposedly as the house guest of Mrs. Brady, who endowed a number of things around here. And the trip was taken over by this auxiliary bishop who was a close friend of Pacelli's, who had worked in the Secretary of State. His name was Francis Spellman. He was auxiliary bishop of Boston. And he and Mrs. Brady had a major falling out because Bishop Spellman knew that Pacelli wanted to meet the president, Roosevelt. So how do you arrange this? And finally, it was done in 1936 through this subterfuge. You had the official hierarchical group working on it through the United States State Department, when all of a sudden Pacelli called the apostolic delegate, the papal representative, to the hierarchy. He said, don't worry, we have made arrangements through Monsignor Spellman. It was done through Joe Kennedy, the father of President John Kennedy. And the idea was that they would meet at the president's mother's house for lunch 2 days after his election to a second term. So it was not an official state visit. Because how did you arrange for the prime minister and foreign minister of an entity with which the United States does not have diplomatic relations to meet with the head of state? So that was the problem.
Going back to the Lateran Pax, of course, beyond that historic signing in 1929, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes work that went on towards that moment, long before that date, no?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the work for that began at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. And there was this interesting priest,
American.
Yeah, Francis Kelly, and he became the Bishop of Oklahoma City later on. But he had in his diary or something how he talked to the foreign minister. And a lot of people thought this was phony until the actual signing of the pact, where the foreign minister of Italy said the first step was taken by this American priest who could sort of be incognito to a great extent. Incidentally, the Lateran treaties did not end hostility between the Holy See and the government. By that time, the fascist government was in control of the government under the king, under the House of Savoy. But by 1931, there was great tension. The Concordat had been violated. So then there was an encyclical condemning fascism.
Pius XI's 1939 encyclical, Non Abbiamo Bisogno, on Catholic Action.
They couldn't publish it in the city because the fascists had shut down the Catholic presses, so it had to be smuggled out of Italy. And they gave it to this then Monsignor Spellman, who was working in the Secretariat of State, because as an American citizen, they weren't going to stop him. And he took it by train to Paris, where it was published by the Associated Press and United Press International, the first encyclical I know of that was not published under official church auspices, but under, you know, the regular journalistic outlets.
And did it get a lot of publicity?
It did, because it was clear then that the Pope was not at all sympathetic with fascism. He was willing to cooperate with them. 2 years later, he signed the Concordat with the Third Reich, with Hitler. And at that time, he made the comment he would sign a concordat with the devil if it meant he could preserve the rights of the church. There's a book done by a German scholar recently they called The Pope and the Devil, because picking up on that phrase. But the purpose of any concordat is to preserve the rights of the church and give it standing, give any dispute standing within international law.
And wasn't he criticized for that?
Oh, yeah, well, especially his Secretary of State. But after all, still, it was the Pope who is the one who authorized the negotiation and the signing of the concordat. But he was criticized because was this recognition of Hitler. Well, it had been under work from 1929, actually, because before Pacelli became Secretary of State, 1914, he was appointed as the nuncio to the Kingdom of Bavaria. And then with the new empire, with the Weimar Republic after 1919, then he became the nuncio also to the Weimar Republic. He was there for another 10 years, 1929, when he came back here to Rome. I say back here to Rome because he was Roman-born.
Pius XI found it hard to actually adapt to the new situation after the signing of the Lateran Pacts. He couldn't be persuaded to move out of the Vatican, but there were some exceptions, like the time he did go to Castel Gandolfo, 1938.
Yes.
And there was a reason connected
Hitler. Because Hitler was making a state visit to the city of Rome, and there was all this preparation, the Via Foro Imperiale. They just probably shoveled over all sorts of ruins to make this wide avenue. Everyone has seen it somewhere near the Colosseum into the
Piazza Venezia.
Yeah, and it's probably under it where a lot of ruins.
Probably destroyed a lot of beautiful things.
Yeah.
Buildings and architectural
marvels. What the Pope did is normally he doesn't go out to Castel Gandolfo until July, although maybe they start going out earlier now because...
Depends on the popes. The popes have had different patterns.
This time he went out in May so that he would not be present. And they also closed the Vatican museums. And then there was debate as to whether or not Hitler would ask for an audience. He didn't. And what would the Pope respond if he did? Then there was a marvelous naval parade because they had to do that in Naples. So they took the train down with Hitler. And the United States naval attaché went down. And they had 90 Italian submarines that all came out in one mass flotilla. And they dove on one end of the harbor. And several minutes later, they all rose at the same time at the other end. And even our United States naval attaché was fascinated by this. For the display in the Piazza Venezia here, most of the ambassadors were not invited, and the United States was not invited, for instance. So the United States ambassador to the kingdom took a seat that he could get. He was getting to be elderly. And nevertheless, he described what happened because Mussolini was fascinated by the Nazi soldiers and their goose step. So he put in what they called the Passo Romano. It was goose stepping Italian troops. Didn't quite work. And a lot of comments in the newspapers because what they were used to was the Passo Italiano, which was much more freewheeling. The Italians cheered when that happened, when they saw it. And by the way, the Pope also had an audience for several hundred newly married couples. at Castel Gandolfo, and he talked about what a crime it was that you had the cross of Christ overshadowed by the crooked cross, the swastika, and that this was a disgrace to the Italian nation as a Christian nation.
And you were listening there to historian and well-known author, Jesuit Father Gerald Fogarty. And now, as announced a moment ago, let's join Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who presents this week's musical meditation.
Some families are very gifted. Think of the Bach family with all those composers, or the Kennedy family with so many leading figures in politics, or the Bronte family, those three sisters who wrote such magnificent novels. If I had to single out the family who made the greatest contribution to writing hymns, I think it would have to be the Wesleys. You've probably heard of John Wesley. He founded the evangelical revival movement in 18th century England and America, which grew into the Methodist Church. But it was his less famous brother, Charles, who wrote most of the hymns, over 6,500 of them. I think that has to be a record. Wesleyan hymns were designed for evangelization. They taught Christian doctrine, they stirred up religious fervour, and they attracted new converts. Imagine hearing them sung with great gusto in large open-air gatherings. No wonder people came flocking.
Jesus, the name I love above, in heaven, earth, or sky, angels and men before it come, and devils fear and cry, and devils fear and fly.
A good number of Charles Wesley's hymns are still sung today. One of the best known is probably this Christmas carol. Another is a well-known hymn for the Ascension. These are not the tunes the Wesleys themselves would have known. Many of the tunes were written much later. The tune for Hark the Herald was written by Mendelssohn, and it was the brainwave of a 19th century editor to match the tune to the words, giving us one of the best loved of all Christmas carols. Hail the Day That Sees Him Rise uses a Welsh tune, again written during the 19th century. But the hymn I want to focus on today is normally sung to a tune written by Charles Wesley's grandson, Samuel Sebastian Wesley. Hymn writing certainly ran in the family. Wesley's son, Samuel, was quite a distinguished composer in his own right, but his son, Samuel Sebastian, is the one better remembered nowadays. The name Sebastian was given him in honour of Johann Sebastian Bach, head of another great musical family. Samuel Sebastian worked as organist in a number of Anglican cathedrals during the 19th century. While he was at Hereford Cathedral, he wrote one of his best-known works, the anthem Blessed Be the God and Father. Hereford is the name of the tune that Samuel Sebastian Wesley wrote for his grandfather's hymn, O Thou Who Camest From Above. It's an excellent hymn to sing at a confirmation or an ordination, because it calls on the Holy Spirit to come down and kindle a flame of sacred love in our hearts. There are echoes of St. Paul's second letter to Timothy as we sing, Still let me guard the holy fire, and still stir up thy gift in me. The final goal of the Christian, though, is the union with God which awaits us at our death. We sing of the acts of faith and love which nourish us spiritually in this life, till death thy endless mercies seal, and make my sacrifice complete.
You're listening there to a program which is part of a series by the title of Music to Watch Angels By, a heavenly hymn book compiled by Monsignor Philip Whitmore. Monsignor Whitmore is a music historian who's currently rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va and then click on the English World icon. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.